With no presidential race this year, all eyes on the national political scene are focused on the Senate. If a handful of Senate seats turn from Democrat to Republican in November, Republicans gain control of the Senate, setting the agenda, chairing the committees, basically in charge of the place. So the Republican Party put some attention and effort into Oregon to find a candidate to challenge first-term Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley. The senator faces pediatric neurosurgeon Monica Webby in his race for re-election. We'd offered airtime to both, and today is Senator Merkley's day to make his case for re-election. Senator Merkley, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Are you sure, after 6 years in Congress, you really want more?
Well, it's a question I ask myself often, given the partisanship, the poisonous atmosphere, and the paralysis. But I feel like part of my mission is to try to restore the working Senate that I knew in the 70s and 80s.
You knew it as an aide to another senator, is that right?
In the 70s, I was an intern for Senator Hatfield, and I dropped out of college for a year to basically pay attention to what was going on in D.C. and wrestle with whether it made more sense to spend my life as an engineer or in public policy. And then in the 1980s, I was a presidential fellow, and then I worked for Congress with the Congressional Budget Office working on strategic nuclear policy. But I saw the Senate. It operated as a competent legislative body, and it doesn't now.
What are you most proud of, would you say, Senator Merkley, of your time in the Senate?
Well, one battle that it really was a big battle was to take on the big banks and say they had to shut down the taxpayer-subsidized hedge fund, so the Wall Street Casino. That was the Volcker Rule. And against the odds, won that battle. But I think something that had a bigger impact on regular families across the country was shutting down the predatory teaser rate mortgages that were afflicting folks, where after 2 years, your interest rate would go from 4% to 9%. Not only did it hurt families, but it hurt our entire economy because that was the foundation of the securities that went bad and caused the 2008 meltdown.
You speak with pride of the Volcker Rule, but there's a general perception anyway that what emerged from Congress in terms of protections for consumers after the Great Recession were perhaps not as great as they could have been. Were they as good as you wanted them to be?
Well, certainly not as good as I'd like, but I'll tell you, when it comes to fighting for consumers, the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is something I championed within Dodd-Frank. And not only did we get that bureau to shut down predatory financial practices, but I played a role later on in leading the fight to change the rules on nominations. So we were actually able to get a head, Richard Cordray, of the CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, so that it could exercise its powers. Blocking that was a primary goal of my colleagues across the aisle. And I'm so glad we succeeded in getting that organization up and running. They've returned $3 billion to consumers who were victims of predatory practices, and they have probably saved Americans, there's no way to measure it exactly, but many times that up front.
You had mentioned the change in the nomination process was something that you had pushed for, something that was pretty much tied up in everything else, as with so many of the filibusters in the Senate. But you had pushed for broader filibuster reform and were not particularly successful in getting that, correct?
So you can break it into two components, the legislative side and the nomination side, or the advice and consent role of the Senate. And so we succeeded in the first half, the first major rule change in 39 years. It changed it from a supermajority to a simple majority to close debate on all executive nominations and all judicial but for Supreme Court. And that's no small deal, because without that, we wouldn't have had not only the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we wouldn't have had a functioning National Labor Relations Board, we wouldn't have had a head of Labor Department, the head of the EPA. And the Republican minority said, we are going to prevent the president from filling any of the positions on the D.C. Circuit Court, the second most important court in the country, because so many decisions go to the Supreme Court through the D.C. Circuit. But as a result of that change, those nominations did get a chance to have a vote, and those three positions have been filled by President Obama, and the pace at which other circuit and district court nominees have been confirmed has doubled. So it's a huge victory for restoring the simple majority advice and consent function envisioned in the Constitution. But you're absolutely right, on the legislative side, we haven't made the changes yet, And I'm laying out a pretty detailed plan that will help the minority and the majority. Help the minority by restoring the ability to have on-topic amendments, which has been a big frustration for the minority, and restore the talking filibuster instead of this silent, deadly, invisible obstruction that we're suffering from at the moment.
So right now, all that has to happen to stop legislation is for a senator to say, I intend to file a filibuster, which does not mean the talking one. It just means you're thinking about it, and that's enough to stop legislation?
No, that's not enough. The way it works is when you plan on closing debate, because nobody has anything left to say, you simply have someone say, well, I move to close debate. But since there is no rule that allows an immediate vote, if someone objects, and so in other words, this effort takes unanimous consent. It's a courtesy extended throughout our couple hundred years of history. And you think about going back to how this started, it was 26 senators from 13 states saying, hey, we can listen to everyone before we take a vote. So it's that courtesy that is being abused, in which someone who has nothing left to say objects. Then under the rules, because this is anticipated to happen just once every few years, not once every week, under the rules you have to file a petition of 16 senators, so you might do that on a Tuesday after being blocked on a Monday. You can't vote on that petition until Thursday, and then if the petition succeeds and you get 60 votes to close debate, you still have to have additional post-cloture debate time. So an entire week is wasted, and if the goal of the minority is not to be problem-solving participants, but instead to paralyze the process, this gives them a very easy tool to do so.
Senator Jeff Merkley, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, running for re-election to his position in the U.S. Senate. This would be his second term if he's elected. Monica Wiebe, the Republican facing him in this campaign. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions or comments for Senator Merkley. 800-838-3760 across our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Senator Merkley, you have what for its time was a fairly typical middle-class upbringing in Oregon, which raises the question, how can someone like you function in a room full of millionaires, and how can a room full of millionaires really do much good at setting policy for working people around the country?
Well, I think your point's well taken. I think we need a lot more folks who come from middle-class America. My dad was a millwright. I was born in Myrtle Creek. Mill shut down. We moved to Roseburg, and then his jobs changed to Multnomah County. But I live in a middle-class community today. My kids go to public school. We have a pretty direct understanding of foreclosures, with several houses on the street foreclosed due to these teaser rate mortgages, and because of the loss of good paying jobs. And so that really motivates me in a very direct fashion to take on these issues, be it predatory credit card practices or predatory mortgages or a failure to invest in infrastructure and create living wage jobs. And we do need more senators from that background. But the challenge is that campaigns are so expensive. There is an inherent advantage to folks running who start with multi-millions of dollars that they can bring to bear themselves. And so we end up with a Senate and with too many members who are disconnected from the real condition here in America.
Obviously, jobs high on the list of everybody running for office this year. There are complaints from some quarters in Oregon that you have not taken a clear position in their minds on federal forest reform on either of the two plans to boost timber harvests from ONC lands. Where do you stand?
Well, we have millions of acres of second growth forest. That is, trees are too close together. They've been replanted. They are good for fires and disease, but they're not very good for either ecosystems or timber stands. So there is a win-win here. We pursued, for example, I met with folks up in John Day where the sawmill was in danger of closing, and said, I'm going to do everything possible to keep this mill open. And the mill owner said, it's not going to happen unless we have a horizon where we have a sustainable supply of logs. Well, in partnership with my colleagues, we were able to work out a 10-year stewardship agreement that improves forest health and creates a steady supply of sawlogs for the mill, and that mill in John Day has increased its employment by 20 full-time individuals, which is a big deal for a small town. So I am immersed in trying to bring together the timber and environmental communities for that type of win-win vision. It's very tricky, and because you go into the woods and you quickly discover the forest changes every 200 yards. And so working out the protocols that both create good ecosystems and good timber stands is not the easiest thing in the world. Senator Wyden, because of his position as ranking member of the Energy and Natural Resource Committee, is the focal point, but I'm trying to facilitate that conversation in every way I can.
When you talk about the forest changing every 200 yards, is one of your concerns then that the legislation that exists for managing the ONC lands considers it too broadly and doesn't consider individual ecosystems and basically the things that environmentalists express concerns about?
Well, the legislation, the broad framework of Senator Wyden's approach is to try to work out the environmental issues on a 10-year cycle where you take on and try to resolve the details of the harvesting strategy. And then for the balance of that 10 years, you've worked out the environmental assumptions, you're out of court, and you can operate much like a stewardship agreement on a broader scale. And then near the end of that 10 years, you turn around and spend 2 years working that out for the next 10 years. But so you have a more reliable strategy. It's the details that he is still negotiating with folks, trying to bring them together, and I'm trying to assist in that. We're in steady conversation about it.
Again, Senator Jeff Merkley, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, running for a second term in the U.S. Senate from Oregon. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments on the issues. 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of discussion in this particular election about the proposal for the liquefied natural gas export terminal, the Jordan Cove terminal in Coos Bay, with the pipeline running across western Oregon to get gas to that terminal for liquefaction. Where do you stand on the Jordan Cove project, Senator?
Well, I largely support the Jordan Cove project. There's going to be probably a single LNG outlet on the West Coast, and the infrastructure investment will be somewhere around $6 to $8 billion. And the Coos Bay area has weighed in heavily in desire to have it. But I'm very concerned about the path of the pipeline. It needs to be on public land whenever possible. I resist the notion of individuals being forced to have the pipeline on their land who don't feel like they're getting a fair shake, if you will.
All right. And what about, we're talking about exporting natural gas. There are also proposals, obviously, to export coal from West Coast ports. Where do you come down on transportation of coal or, for that matter, crude oil by rail?
I see the coal very differently in that there is a possibility of the natural gas in limited amounts, and it's a go-slow strategy, but it could replace a lot of the much more carbon-intensive coal burning in Asia. And if the natural gas is extracted responsibly, which is right now we need some major improvements on the control of how that extraction is done.
Fracking, in other words.
Fracking and the methane that is released, people refer to it as fugitive methane that comes out of the ground. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long as carbon dioxide, but it has a powerful global warming impact. But we take coal, we have to leave in the ground the vast majority of the identified fossil fuel reserves, or we're going to fry this planet. We have greatly increased the carbon dioxide pollution in the atmosphere. It's over 400 parts per million now, which hasn't been seen for, millions of years. And that has already had an impact. You can see the impact on our rural economy. It's affecting our fishing, our forests, and our farming. You see the farming impact through the droughts in the Klamath Basin. You see the impact on forests through the pine beetle and the longer fire season in the summer and the greater number of acres that are being burned. You see the impact on the fishing through the oysters. Oysters on the coast are having trouble reproducing because the ocean's 30% more acidic today than it was before the Industrial Revolution. That's kind of a canary in the coal mine, or in this case, an oyster in the Pacific Ocean that's saying something's not right here, and there's more trouble to come. So we have to dramatically reduce the burning of fossil fuels, and we should not be facilitating going the other direction by establishing coal ports.
All right, so gas as an alternative to a dirtier burning coal, a better thing to export.
On the LNG, yes.
All right, let's take a call from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon.
Thank you. Since we don't have a democracy if we don't have campaign finance reform, because now it's like 0.1% of the population is having a huge effect on elections, how can we get campaign finance reform? Because the very people who are benefiting from that 0.1% try to block, or definitely do block, anything that's proposed.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it.
Ann's exactly right. We have a terrible problem with a concentration of money in campaigns. We've seen it here in Oregon this summer. I mean, this really reads a little bit like a conspiracy novel, but it is, in fact, the way things unfolded in the last few months. The out-of-state oil and coal billionaires, the Koch brothers, held a meeting in California designed to raise $500 million to secure control of the Senate for their agenda. They apparently only raised $300 million, but that's still a huge sum. They held a vetting conference for Republican candidates in Texas to make sure that the candidates running on the Republican ticket for the Senate signed on to their agenda. My opponent in this race, I don't know if she went to the conference in Texas, but she did sign on to the entire Koch brother agenda. And then they proceeded to come here and spend millions of dollars in August and September run attack ads and promote her candidacy, utilizing, by the way, a charitable organization to do so they didn't have to disclose all their donors.
But the 501c4?
501c4, yes. But the heart of it, certainly, it's the Koch brothers' fortune driving this. And this is enormously corrupting to democracy. It takes away the sense of we the people and replaces it with the notion of a nation by and for the few and powerful. And I'm delighted to report that Oregonians rejected the Koch brother agenda. They rejected their advertising, and the Koch brothers took down their campaign at the end of September. That was still after many millions of dollars had been spent. But they're across the country right now in Alaska, North Carolina, and Arkansas, and Louisiana, and Iowa, and you name it, New Hampshire. Spending these hundreds of millions of dollars trying to buy the U.S. Senate, it's something every one of us should be deeply concerned about. It's why I'm supporting a constitutional amendment, and we was blocked by a filibuster here a few weeks ago, but why I'm supporting it to give the power to regulate third-party expenditures. We currently have McCain-Feingold law that reduces individual donations directly to a candidate to a level that most people couldn't contribute anyway, a couple thousand dollars, $2,600. And most people, if they can contribute $25 or $50 or $100, that's a lot. But at least the limit of $2,600 means that no one individual is spending millions on your behalf, kind of buying your allegiance, buying an agenda. But that's what the Koch brothers are doing with third party. And it's just wrong for democracy. Citizens United decision that allowed this, that said this was not corrosive or corrupting, is absolutely off basis. It's completely disconnected to reality, and it's why I'm working to overturn it. We also need to have the Security Exchange Commission say that if you are a stockholder in a company, in other words, you are an owner of a company, you have a right to know how they spend their political money on lobbying and on campaign donations. And we need to have the IRS and Treasury Department reverse the rule that allowed, basically, this is the most Orwellian thing I've encountered in public life. They have a rule that says when the law says that donations to a charitable organization have to be used exclusively for charitable activities, exclusively means primarily. And that reduced 100% standard down to a 50.1% standard and created the loophole that a lot of the 501c4s utilized. And let me be clear, this sort of end to the abuse of the 501c4 organization has to happen across the board, not just one part of the political spectrum. This is for people on the left and people on the right.
So let's talk about how things might move in the next Senate. I mean, is the agenda, are the things that you would push for very different if this is a Republican Senate versus what you'd push for in a Democratic-controlled Senate, Senator?
No, the things I'll push for will be the same. For example, with the filibuster reform, I've laid out reforms that are ripe, whether you're in the minority or the majority. It addresses the concerns of both sides. My fight for creating living wage jobs and to end predatory financial practices, that certainly I will continue in that fight. Now, give you a sense of this, for example, in the Oregon legislature, where I served for 10 years, 8 years in the minority and 2 years in the majority, I fought to end predatory payday loans for 8 years in the minority and lost. But when I became speaker in the majority, we won, and we were able to get rid of those 500% interest rate loans across Oregon to the great benefit of Oregonians. And so I'll continue the fight. Maybe the prospects for a few of the victories diminishes, but hopefully I can win over some of my Republican colleagues with an appeal to building a better nation for American families to thrive.
Just a couple seconds left. I know Monica Webby accuses you of ducking a debate in Portland today, and yet there have been accusations the other way. What's the truth about the Portland appearance?
We agreed to 5 joint appearances. She skipped 3 of them and then came under so much heat for doing so that she arranged one at the last moment that conflicted with our schedule.
All right, Senator Jeff Merkley, thank you much for spending time with us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much.
All right. Senator Jeff Merkley running for re-election to the U.S. Senate against Republican Monica Webby. The election is November 4th. Ballots are in the hands of Oregonians right now.